Welcome to Standing Room Only, featuring lectures, town hall meetings, and other public forums recorded on location by WFHB community volunteers. This program amplifies voices not adequately represented in mainstream media to help raise public consciousness of issues affecting life in South Central Indiana and beyond.
Tonight on Standing Room Only, Voting Rights and Wrongs, Minority Voting Rights and Disenfranchisement. On Friday, September 16th, the Maurer School of Law hosted a panel discussion on minority voting rights in America and in Indiana. Panelists included Professor David Williams, a professor from Maurer and the executive director for the Center for Constitutional Democracy, Professor Luis Fuentes Brower, a professor at Maurer, and Senator Greg Taylor from the Indiana General Assembly. Professor Beth Kay also took part in the discussion, along with moderating the event. The panel discussed constitutional rights, a history of voting rights in America, and the state of minority voting rights in Indiana today. We begin today's lecture with opening remarks from Dean of the Maurer School of Law, Dean Austin L. Parrish.
I'd like to thank you for coming to today's event. I think it's going to promise to be a lively discussion on voting rights in America, the impact on voting laws on minority populations specifically, and comparative lessons to be learned from countries that struggle to achieve universal suffrage. It's a particularly opportune time for us to be talking about this because, well, unless you haven't been alive, there's a lot going on with voting right now. And there's a number of challenges in the courts the federal courts, at least, tackling cases involving state voting rules and whether those rules are unlawful barriers to minority ballot access. We are fortunate today to have a tremendous panel of experts to help us dissect these issues at a sophisticated level and discuss the problems and the potential solutions. And so I'm going to introduce the speakers. So we have Professor Fuentes Brower, who earned his JD and PhD. You can stand up right and no. I'm just kidding. Professor Fuentes Brower from the University of Michigan and an LLM from Georgetown Law School. He's a Harry T. Ice faculty fellow here at the Maurer School of Law. He is an expert on voting rights and the intersection of race and democracy, including particularly the Reconstruction era and its impact. He's published a number of articles exploring race and voting rights and the future of the Voting Rights Act. His courses on voting rights, civil rights and legal history, constitutional law in the Reconstruction era, and race and democratic theory are extremely popular not only with our own students, but with undergraduates who are lucky to have them for class as part of the law and public policy major. Next to Professor Fuentes Brower's left is Professor David Williams. Make you wave as well. Professor Williams received his JD from Harvard Law School and is the John S. Hastings Professor of Law here at the law school. He serves as the executive director of the Center for Constitutional Democracy, which advises on constitutional drafting and reform in numerous developing countries, including Burma, Liberia, and Vietnam. The center also trains civil society groups and traditionally excluded peoples on how to strengthen their participation in governance. His expertise in Native American law adds a further dimension to his deep awareness of the challenges in achieving a political voice for marginalized peoples. And finally, on Professor Fuentes Brower's right is Professor Beth Kate, who will be moderating this event. Professor Kate is another Harvard Law School graduate. She joined the SPIA faculty after practicing for 20 years and now serves as a clinical associate professor. Her scholarly teaching interests include constitutional law as well as the law and policy surrounding intellectual property and data governance. Professor Kate also serves as faculty coordinator of SPIA's Law and Public Policy major, or LPP, which is a unique collaboration between SPIA and the law school, featuring opportunities for undergraduates to take courses from law faculty in their areas of expertise, pursue certain scholarship and mentorship opportunities for law study at the law school, and participate in co-curricular programs that take a deep dive into pending issues of law and public policy, like today's discussion. Let me go back then to introducing Senator Greg Taylor. Senator Taylor is a graduate, and we're very proud of this, of our own law school. He's practiced extensively in the areas of business law, public finance, and economic development. Senator Taylor was elected to represent Indiana Senate District 33 in November of 2008, and he serves on the Indiana Black Legislative Caucus and is the ranking minority member of the Senate Elections Civil Law Committee, along with many other appointments at the Senate. Senator Taylor has lent his talents and expertise to regional and national organizations as well. He serves on the Law, Criminal Justice, and Public Safety Committee of the National Conference of State Legislators, a bipartisan organization that serves the legislature and staffs nations of 50 states, its commonwealths, and their territories, the National Legislative Conference of the Council of State Governments Economic Development Committee, and the Midwestern Legislative Conference Economic Development Committee. And so we're very pleased that Senator Taylor is going to join us shortly. Let me end by wanting to thank the organizers and co-sponsors of this event for bringing together this distinguished panel. Tonight we're very pleased that we're sponsored by the Law Student BALSA Association, by the Pre-Law BALSA Association, and the College Democrats, the Center on Constitutional Democracy, and SPIA. It's great to have that sort of collaboration to bring together different voices and put together this panel. I've spoken too long, so thank you so much for coming. Thank you, Beth, for putting this on, and thank you for participating. I'll turn it over to you.
Thank you very much. Thank you so much, and thank all of you for being here, particularly on what has turned out to be a very rainy day indeed. Let me turn to, first Professor Williams to start us off with just a few brief comments from your experience on including traditionally excluded groups in governance. Yeah.
So the goal of the discussions today is really to spark conversation, not to present formal papers. And we have been instructed to keep our remarks within 10 minutes, which is absolutely impossible for either an academic or a politician. But I actually am going to try to keep it within 10 minutes. And to do that, I'm going to make three general points that I hope will nonetheless be provocative. The first point is the following. As Dean Parrish pointed out, I advise foreign reformers all the time on putting together constitutions. One of the things that I have learned in doing this is that unless everyone gets a good deal, no one gets a good deal, because the Constitution will fall apart. It's not just that it's unjust to give some minority group a bad deal, it's that it is threatening to the stability of the regime. Now, Americans take for granted that our regime is stable. And there are an awful lot of people who say, yes, we acknowledge that there are small groups, minority groups, that are profoundly alienated. The answer is more police. In the long run, the answer is not more police. America is not actually proof against the sort of things that have happened in places where we've been advising, places like Burma, Yemen, Libya, Tunisia. It's not proof against that. And in the last 3 years, I have seen more fundamental cracks in our constitutional fundament than I have ever seen before. The answer to this is structural change. Let me tell you a brief story from my personal history. My wife, Susan, co-directs the CCD with me. Our first house, she didn't like it, but I did, and I kind of pressured her into moving into this house. But she took her revenge, because she was intent on changing the house to be a house more like what she wanted. So every weekend, she made me work on the house. We didn't have enough money back then to have somebody else do it. And so all week long, I'd work at work, and all weekend long, I'd work at home, and eventually I came to hate that house. And this is the point. A constitution is like a house. You're going to have to live in it together. And an electoral system is the same. Now, you might live in different rooms, you might have different values and customs, and so forth and so on. You can appreciate diversity, but you've got to be able to live with the same structure, or else it will fall apart. And it is important to get ahead of what's happening now, because actually what's happening is we're all running behind. And this is not just about minority voting, this is about the chaos that is this presidential campaign season. That's observation number one. Closely related to that is observation number two. We're approaching Constitution Day. The subtext of Constitution Day is it's really celebrate the Constitution Day, and I think that's great. The Constitution has done great things for us. I also think it's time to have another window on this, which is bash the Constitution Day. Criticize the Constitution Day. Our Constitution right now is not serving us all that well. I used to work for Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who of course became famous for saying that our Constitution is not the most perfect in the world. I will go farther and say it's not the most perfect for us. We are in desperate need of constitutional amendment, partially because our government is paralyzed, but partially because increasingly there are groups that feel alienated and separate from the general American experiment. Now, that includes voters of color. It also includes a lot of the populists who supported Bernie Sanders and are supporting Donald Trump. We need to get out ahead of this and know why. What I have noticed among Americans is there's a tremendous tendency to think if we have problems, it's because we have evil politicians. If only we had better politicians. The reality is we get the politicians that our system selects for us. If there's a problem right now, it's because we have the wrong system. And Americans need to get serious about looking at that system. Now, when I tell Americans that, they get the heebie-jeebies because they say, oh, you're talking about cooking the rules of the game, about rigging things so things go differently. Now, I got news for you. Every constitutional system in the world is rigged. It's cooked. I have written a number of constitutions, and I have cooked them for certain ends, because you have to. We have to have a conversation about what kind of politics we want and how we can rearrange our constitutional deck furniture to get there. Because if we don't, we're surely going down with the Titanic. Okay, that's the second point. Here's the third point. For that reason, Americans need to get vastly more sophisticated about the constitutional choices in front of us. Americans tend to assume, because we are a continental country, that the way we do it is the only possible way to do it. And as a result, to think about some alternative seems unthinkable to them. Sometimes it's because it seems foreign, ghastly, European even, which would be, of course, horrible. But in any event, you're altering it so as to rearrange power. Now, that's what all constitutions do. They rearrange power. They do that ab initio, and they do that whenever you amend it. Our Constitution was written so as to rearrange power, and we are still living within that power arrangement. And there is no necessity that we stay within it. Okay. Now, let me just give you a real quick example about electoral law. We have a winner-takes-all system. In our system, we have single-member districts, which means from any given congressional or state legislative district, typically we elect one person. And that one person gets 100% of the power, right? Because it's the only person elected. So if I run for this congressional district and I get 52% of the vote, I am the only representative from this district. So I don't get 52% of the power. I get 100% of the power, not 52% of the power, because it's a winner-takes-all system. Now, I got to tell you, because most Americans don't know this, this is not the only way to do it. You could actually make arrangements so that the power would be proportional, but it's not. 52% becomes 100%. Now, this is relevant to minority voting. Because when that's the case, you have a tremendous incentive to get a ton of votes. If you get 35% of the votes, forget it. You get nothing. Who cares? You go home. You go fishing, right? Hopefully you don't get killed. But that's all you get. You get nothing. If you get 52%, you get everything. Now, what does that incentivize you to do? First, the parties are going to run what are called the most broadly acceptable candidates. Okay? That's built into the structure of our electoral law. Most broadly acceptable means the person likely to garner the most votes. Now, let me call your attention to certain facts of American demography. There are not many people in this country who will vote against a man simply because he's a man. They may vote against him because they don't like him, but they're not likely to vote against him because he's a man. There are a ton of people who will vote against a woman simply because she's a woman. And again, winner takes all. You're running only one person. Who are you going to run? If you're a party, you're going to run a man, because he's going to have a better chance, because there's only one person. There are not many people in this country who will vote against a white person simply because he or she is a white person. There are a ton of people who will vote against a person of color simply because he or she is a person of color. Who are you going to run? You're going to run a white person, right? Unless you have geographical segregation, where you have African-American districts or Hispanic-American districts or the like. Now, you look at the American Congress, is it any surprise that so many of them are white men? This is because it's built into our system, and there are other ways to do it. Second, you need a lot of votes to win in our system because it's winner takes all. So where are you going to inhabit? Mostly you're going to inhabit the center. If you're way over here, you're going to get votes way over here, but not many other votes. If you're here, there's one here and one here, and that's what our system tends to give rise to, two centrist parties. If you're the Democrat, you're going to get all these votes all the way over. You can take for granted the votes on the hard left. You can mostly take for granted minority voters, because they're not going to vote for the Republican. They're going to vote for you. The only thing you're worried about is turning out the vote. This is built into our system. Now, I don't have time to go into the alternatives, but there are alternatives in which, if you move to those, diversity in the legislature goes way up. People on the margins are better represented. I'm not advocating for them because they have problems too. This is a choice. Every electoral system has problems. The great thing, though, is if we're aware of them, sophisticated about them, we can make those choices self-consciously. Right now, America is not doing that. So I'm not saying change. What I am saying is, talk.
You've been listening to Voting Rights and Wrongs, Minority Voting Rights and Disenfranchisement on Standing Room Only on WFHB. Just listen to Professor David Williams give his opening remarks at a panel hosted at Maurer School of Law on September 16th. We return now to Professor Luis Fuentes Rauer delivering his opening presentation.
Professor Fuentes Rauer.
Good afternoon, and thank you for coming. I worried. The rain got bad at some point in the afternoon, and I thought you wouldn't come. Thank you for coming. Give me one second. I'll be really brief. That was, by the way, really powerful. Really, really powerful. I hope that it was as powerful to you as it was to me just listening to it for the umpteenth time. By that I mean, you know, he's packaging it in a way that I hope we get to talk about shortly. So let me, very briefly, because I want to get to our conversation more than anything, let me start with a graph. This is my 10 minutes, if I get to even 10 minutes in a nutshell. I want you to see two things here. One, the graph is tracking the number of black elected officials throughout American history. So if you see the 250 up there, 300, 350, 200, 150, you see them here on the left. If you go on the bottom, this is, if you can see it, it's dates. Here's a few things I want you to think about. If I were to show you, and I'm going to move it back so that here's when I ask you a trick question. Here's the 15th Amendment. If I were to tell you or ask you, I wouldn't tell you. I'd ask you first and I would tell you. How did black voters come to the polls for the first time in American history you point to the 15th Amendment, guaranteed, you always do in class. That would be the wrong answer. Turns out the 15th Amendment, believe it or not, has been almost a dead letter until 1965. And I want to show you in our time, in my 10 minutes, why, so we can think about what's happening today. You know, it's one of these moments. History has a funny way of ebbing and flowing. We're in a flow right now, coming back to a place we've been before. Not a good place. And we'll see what happens as we move to the future. An interesting place to look to here, Section 2. What does that mean? That's important. Section 2 gives Congress the power to enforce the article you see, Section 1, by appropriate legislation. That's a, needless to say, a term of art. And so we have been thinking about for a long time, we the people, we in this country, what that means, how much power that gives Congress. And that is key to this conversation, turns out. And here's why. Yeah, let me show you. Notice the graph. It begins, again, number of black elected officials. Think about that. On the left, at the local, state, and national level. Notice what happens. 1868, we're way up there. Why are we up there? Well, here's why. The Military Reconstruction Act of 1867. I hope that makes sense to you. I hope you appreciate how interesting that is. Black men got the right to vote because Congress forced the South, the Republicans in Congress, then Republicans at the time, forced the South to bring black men to the polls. Without that force, without, and in fact, the stick was either you let them vote in your new state constitution post-war, or else you don't get to come back to the Union. So you have a choice, if you want to think of it as a choice. In the meantime, you're a military district with a leader appointed, a military leader appointed by us, the Northern National Government. And he will stay there until you decide to do what we want you to do. Notice what happened, 68, 70, 72. Notice how it sort of moves up, but 1870 was not the driving force here. The 50th Amendment wasn't the one time or the one moment when the graph began to take off. And then notice what happened, 72, 74, 76. If you see 76, 78, that's what we know as the Compromise of 1876, the election of Hayes versus Tilden, when basically we the North, if you want to think of it that way, left the South. The country basically got back together. And notice what begins to happen up to the turn of the century. That's important. Why? 1890, we know that date in voting rights law as the date or the year when the Mississippi Plan was enacted. What is that, you ask? It was the time when the South began to basically push back hard against minority voting rights in their jurisdictions. This is when what you now know, we all know this, the poll taxes and literacy tests and grandfather clauses, registration laws, a secret ballot, I could go on, felon disenfranchisement laws, all of those came about en masse in 1890. Mississippi's the first one to do this, and after that, other states figured out that was a pretty good thing, and they began to do it too, up until 1910. That's when Oklahoma did theirs. And that basically, that chapter closed 20 years. And the numbers are staggering. And I show you number of elected officials because it's harder to get good data on black participation at the time. We weren't keeping those records for reasons that should be apparent to you. We know blacks were wiped out from the polls. Some state, North Carolina is a big one, Virginia is another one. Then when the one of the, some numbers are down to zero. In Louisiana, they started with 130,000 registered voters, black voters, ended up with under 1,000 within 3 years. We know how it happened, and we know why it happened. Once you implement, think about voting. What is voting about? It's about cost and benefit. Excuse me. When you get up in the morning and it's voting day, you say, boy, it's raining outside, and the poll is far away. And, oh boy, I forgot to register. And my state, demand that I register 29 days in advance. Why? Because it does. Lots of states, by the way. Minnesota's one, Iowa's another. There's many others. Register same day. We don't do that in Indiana for reasons I'm happy to think about with you if you want. The point is, registering is a cost. A cost that comes way ahead. Funny, there's a table outside. To try to lower that cost for you, by the way. And I don't mean that as a cynical, funny, jokey thing, but that's fact. Poll taxes, it's a cost, an actual cost. Grandfather clauses try to help you with that cost, but the point is, at the end of the day, voter ID laws, right, it's a cost. Polls open 1 hour. It's a cost on you. Polls away from your house. Well, 1890, the cost rose exponentially. So much so, in fact, that people just wouldn't risk it anymore. But notice, here's what's interesting. By the turn of the century, black voters were basically eviscerated. When do they come back? They come back in 1965, 66, 68. Notice how the graph begins to take off again. And that's interesting. Why? Because it wasn't the 15th Amendment. It was Congress again through the Voting Rights Act. So the question to ask, I'm assuming you're wondering, how? When we talk about the Voting Rights Act, it's interesting. We call it the Voting Rights Act. When you say the Voting Rights Act, these are my points Scalia made many times. Who's going to be against that? Against the Voting Rights Act? Well, he was, and many others were too. I mean, I'm going to show you. That wasn't even a joke. But I will take it. Here's why the opposition came. Here's what the Voting Rights Act did, and then I'm going to stop so we can get to our conversation. But this is, it gets us to where we are today so we understand why there's cases out of North Carolina, there's cases out of Texas, there's cases out of basically everywhere. States are, in fact, before I get to that, notice, I want you to just make sure you get this. States are not quite to 1890 again, but it's the same conversation. And I don't mean it racially, though we can surely talk about that. And the Fourth Circuit in the North Carolina case said precisely that, yes, this is racial. Racial the way it used to be. They found, and I quote, a smoking gun in the case, in the voter ID case out of North Carolina. And I'm assuming it'll come up in our conversation. Point is, when I said about ebbs and flow, we went up, we came down. We went up. We're not quite coming down the same way. But the larger point is, states are pushing back the way they pushed back before, which is what I mean. This is not new. Think about that. Second big point, and I'm going to get to the voter side, then I'm going to stop. When people have gotten to the polls, we think of it in Pollyannish ways. Something David said that's interesting among one of the things he said. What is it I thought about when he's talking about the Constitution? Think about this. What is a Constitution? And I don't mean it on paper. What is a piece of paper, which my students would tell you? I say that probably way too many times. The Constitution is who we are, who we decide to be. We think about it, when we think about voting right, we think about Pollyannishly, everybody votes. Turns out, the way people vote, it's via lots of struggle. It's happened every time, whether it's for African Americans, for Latinos, for women. Think about the 19th Amendment. If you think after 1920, if you think people just went to the polls and magically just everything was fine and hunky-dory, you would be, of course, incorrect. Of course, getting there was really hard. And if I remember the name of the movie that I love, and I forget it every time, Iron Judd Angels, ha, good for me. Amazing movie, so that you understand how much it took for women to actually be allowed the right to vote. Incredible. Same story. Ebbs and flows. So here, let me just show you very briefly how we went up. Here's how. Section 2, which is in the news today. The cases are coming down here. What did Congress do? It said no voting qualification, prerequisite to voting, or standard practice or procedure shall be imposed or applied by any state or political subdivision. These are all terms of art, by the way, but we don't have enough time. I'm happy to do us. To explain, but basically, to the narrow breach of the right to vote of any citizen on account of race or color. What is Congress doing in 1965? It's codifying the 15th Amendment, and that's crucial. It wasn't crucial at the time. Critics of the act back in 65 left Section 2 alone. which proved to be a strategic mistake. Because this is now, this is where the game is at presently. What does that mean? Does it mean, and then, again, we can talk forever. Is Congress tracking the constitutional standard, or is Congress expanding the constitutional standard? And that's a conversation, as I said, in the cases today. And it's a big conversation, and it might be a difficult one. Point is, that's at the time in 65, that was just dormant. Until 1980, there was a case, and then lawyers got fanciful, and this expanded. But set that aside. Here's the big one. And this is, and I'm going to stop here when I show you. Section 4B. Congress said, in light of the problems, and we sort of knew where the problems were, Congress said, look, we're going to create what we know as covered jurisdictions. What does that mean? It means this. If you have a literacy test, number one, and you have one of two things, either your voter registration on this particular date, 64, November 1st, 1964, or your voter turnout for the 64 presidential election, if either one of those two things is true, and you have a literacy test, you become a Section 4B covered jurisdiction. And that is massive. Why? And by the way, if you're wondering which are the covered jurisdictions, it's a really fun game in class. You guys start guessing which are the covered jurisdictions, and you get half of them wrong. It was basically Louisiana, it was Mississippi, it was Alabama, it was Georgia, it was South Carolina, it was select counties in North Carolina, about 25 of them. It was Virginia. It was Alaska. Funny thing, and they bailed out immediately. Then they came back in because of the Alaska native population, but years later. In years, in subsequent years, Congress kept extending Section 4B, and then Texas came on board, Arizona through the language provisions, and so on. Notice, by the way, which is what makes this critical, if not interesting, if not controversial. Look, tell me what that looks like to you. Here's what Justice Black said. Here's what critics in Congress said. You're taking us back to Reconstruction. That's what you're doing. Here's why, and I'm going to stop because we have to move. What does that mean? It means if you're a covered jurisdiction, any change in the law, basically, courts understood Section 5 so broadly, any change, if you want to go to voter ID laws, if you want to move your polling places, if you want to change your voting hours, if you want to go from computers to pencils, from pencils to computers, if you want to annex land, if you want to do just about anything related to voting, you must pre-clear it with either the district court in D.C. or the attorney general. Why? Because we presume whatever you do is unconstitutional until you prove otherwise. And the burden, yes, sir, is on you. And if you know burdens, as you know from CivPro first year, if you do, if you don't, you'll get there. And if you don't, you're not missing anything. Just kidding. Just kidding. Just kidding. That means that's a big deal. So then states couldn't do anything until D.C. said, yes, you can. Hence, that's when we see voters of color now coming to the voting rolls in the ways that they did. Here's what's interesting, and I'm going to stop right now. As soon as Shelby County struck down Section 4B, states came back immediately to impose new restrictions on voting. Texas, on the same day of Shelby County, they said, ah, lucky for us, we have a bill in hand. North Carolina, within a week, did it, and so on. So now the debates we're having are debates in the wake of Shelby County, which struck down Section 4B. So now the presumption shifts again. Now, if you want to challenge a law, it's on you to go to court and prove the law is unconstitutional. And the state, of course, defends it. And so these cases you're seeing are remarkable in how courts are siding with plaintiffs in ways they never did before. It'll come up in our conversations. I am gonna stop and let our senator take over. And thank you.
A lot of passion in this room. We had a very bold and provocative opening. It's continued. And now I want to introduce Senator Taylor.
All right.
Thank you so much. I know you had a bit of a difficult journey getting here, so thank you for joining us.
Road funding issues.
And we want to give you an opportunity to make some opening comments on how things look in Indiana and with current state rules in Indiana and anything else, and then we'll jump into our conversation from there.
First of all, thank you for having me. I relish the time being here as a student sitting somewhere back there in the back row. In the back row, like Professor Brown wouldn't call on me, but he did anyway. The state of Indiana has, over the last 5 years, passed several pieces of legislation that you might be very fond of if you are someone who believes that there's a lot of voter fraud out there. And then for those of you who actually read, you see that there's been a change in the way that we do voting. Not only for how people vote or who can vote, but the procedures. I've been in the legislature since 2008, and I have to say, at least 5 years in a row, we've changed how, for example, how you vote at large. And if, for those of you that don't know what that means if you have, for example, five seats and you've got seven people running for those seats, it used to be that you could vote straight party ticket and whoever was on that Democrat ticket would get your votes. Well, that is no longer the law. The law is now that you must go directly to that at-large race and pick the individuals and fill in the bubble or pull the lever or whatever you do depending on your voting machine. That was just this year. The most heinous thing we did was the voter ID. If you remember Crawford case, I don't know if you guys read that case or not, Professor Kate, but Bill Crawford, who was a legislator, filed a lawsuit in regards to the voter ID, and I believe because there was no information or no data that showed that that had a disproportionate effect on minorities, that case was thrown out and the law was upheld. As you've seen over the last 5 or 6 months, there have been several cases, including the case in North Carolina, where the court has actually overturned the voter ID law because they have found, through the information that's been provided over the last several years, that voter ID law does lead to lower voter turnout in minority populations. I'll leave you with this. Because I think you get the gist of what I'm saying. But what's important to understand in Indiana is it's always been one of those states that I believe has had a significant amount of potential to make monumental changes that affect the everyday lives of even people like yourself. But being in the legislature for the last 8 years, I noticed one thing. And we tend to live in our own little bubble, and we always believe people think the same way that we do. Logic doesn't really prevail a lot. You would think it would because you have a lot of people who can look at data and actually see the effect. But people come up with other excuses. For example, this last voter turnout for Indiana, I don't know if you guys all know this, we had the lowest voter turnout in the country. Well, there are some people who believe that's not true because they said that that's based on some other theorem or theory that, you know, everybody wants to vote in Indiana. So based on the people who's registered, which is the, in my opinion, if you register, you want to vote, versus who went to vote, that's the percentage we use. They said, no, you should really take the total population of voting age people, and then when you do that, Indiana falls in the middle. So, I'll leave you with that, and I'll leave it, that's my 10-minute spiel, if you will, 5-minute spiel.
You've been listening to Voting Rights and Wrongs, Minority Voting Rights and Disenfranchisement on Standing Room Only on WFHB. just listened to Senator Greg Taylor speak about minority voting rights at a panel hosted at Maurer School of Law on September 16th. We return now to moderator Professor Beth Kate asking her first question to the three panelists.
Thank you very much. Well, let's go ahead then and get into more of a discussion among all of you, and ultimately we will open it up to questions from the audience as well. At this point, what do you think is the likelihood, in the wake of the decisions we've been seeing out of a number of courts, North Carolina was mentioned, Texas and others, that Congress is going to turn its attention to fixing that problem, closing that hole, by effectively renewing, coming up with a new formula for deciding what jurisdictions are engaging in these practices and require preclearances? Are we going to see a fix for that?
I think the answer is very simple. I'm going to let you guess. Fine, we don't have time. No. And here's why. This is a big conversation people are having in the voting rights scholarship. Every conference has a panel talking about, should Congress simply reenact Section 4B? Should we just do that again? But now, because of what the court said in Shelby County was, you're using data from 1972. And that data is now getting us to keep people locked in 2006. There's, you know, the means and the nexus, the fit between data and reality doesn't fit. You need to tune the data to the facts today. So go ahead and find me the data that gets us to those states, and then we'll allow it. So then, of course, once you come to Congress and say, sure, we have problems. Let's enact a new coverage formula, what Congress has said. I mean, of course, every legislator said, we want no part of it. In fact, what happened in 65, I didn't say it, but one non-negotiable fact was, Texas better not be covered. And the reason for that, I'm sure you could imagine, was because Lyndon Johnson was the president. Mm-hmm. And it would be embarrassing to get the president's, I mean, of course, this is a site, by the way, of the white primary cases. And I'm the infamous, and they're not covered by Section 4B. The point being, once the debate begins in Congress, assuming Congress is willing to do anything nowadays, which is up for debate, this one, they're not doing. So people are shifting gears and saying, well, maybe we should think universally, which I'm happy to talk to you about. Now, let's not think about targeting voters and targeting states and thinking about minority voters. Rather, let's think about universally about the right to vote. I'm protecting that. And if you protect that, then it lives all boats, not just, as people think about this, minority votes. You know, rising tide, lift all boats. Right. So that's the conversation today. And people are now going back and forth. But as far as Congress redoing Section 4B, that's very unlikely. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Does anyone else want to jump in on that? Or yeah, okay.
I agree. I think there's very, very little incentive for Congress to do anything, and especially to reenact Section 4B. Just so everybody understands, we draw the congressional maps in Indiana. So, as a legislator, when I vote in 2020, and we have these maps where everybody represents a district. By the way, I represent a district that's 76% Democrat. You think that is not gerrymandering? As I tell people, I could go urinate into the fountain in the center of downtown Indianapolis the day before the election, and I would probably win by 10 points. There's no system in place or check and balance for that, and Congress knows that. So if you're a congressperson and you know that you could change the way that Indiana draws their maps, do you think you're going to come back and say, hey, we know that you draw your maps disproportionately to affect one group over the other, and we're going to tell you before you do that, you got to come to us and get approval? That's absolutely not going to happen, especially, and I can speak specifically for the state of Indiana, but most other states do. Now, there are a few states who have panels, who draw maps. You see, you don't get maps where, you know, my colleague who's on the west side of Indianapolis has a 72% Democrat district. But then all of a sudden, you start going to the outer areas and you find districts at 92% Republican, 98% Republican, 75% Republican, because voter registration, there's a little app, you just take the voter registration and take the little mouse and draw it, and it actually draws the map for you. It's amazing. It's a great piece of technology.
There's the program, actually, you can push a button to say max blue or max red.
Right.
And it will redraw all the boundaries in Indiana to give you a maximum Republican legislature or a maximum Democratic legislature, because we have really good demographic information these days. The district controls the outcome of elections. Voters think they do, politicians think they do, neither actually controls, the districters control.
Right.
So given that, to what extent are we likely to see in Indiana or in other states, we've seen it in a few so far, attempts at turning districting over to independent / bipartisan districting commissions that will attempt to draw districts largely using these big data programs in a way that would seem less partisan and more fair and based on criteria of, you know, compactness, contiguousness, and things like that?
We already have a study committee to study that right now. Mm-hmm. I don't know what we need to study. It's pretty, I mean, I don't know if any of you are questioning whether or not that program can be manipulated. But we are studying that issue right now. And we're talking about issues of compactness. There's a district, for example, that I call the Pac-Man district. And it's Madison County. And if you look at the map, the two counties, it's Madison, and I forget, Muncie's in Delaware County. So it'd be Madison and Delaware County. And they're kind of square like this. Well, you got Anderson and Muncie, and there's a state senator who represents those two areas. And then around it, like this, in the shape of Pac. So in other words, he could travel from the north side of his district to the south side of his district and go in somebody else's district. Now, who would ever thought that's the proper way to draw a map? But what they did is they took rural areas and drew them, and then they took in the middle and took the, and then the most heinous is a district that goes from Indianapolis, you got a little slither on the east side, all the way over to Richmond. Really? What do people in Richmond have in common with the east side of Indianapolis?
Now, what I would like to add, actually, is that the rest of the world views us as totally crazy.
Yes.
Idea that the state legislatures should district themselves and should district congressional districts is regarded as totally crazy. Mm-hmm. The norm in almost all the rest of the world is electoral commissions. Now, Arizona has an electoral commission. You know why? Because they have the power of popular initiative.
Right.
The legislature was never going to do this. Mm. The people took it into their own hands to insist upon right. an electoral commission. Yeah. This went before the Supreme Court. Mm-hmm. There was a big question. My justice, RBG, said this is legal, but there was a big constitutional challenge even to that, that maybe electoral commissions are illegal in this country. Turns
That's
out
close,
they're not.
Close case.
Close case. Turns out they're not. So now it's up to the state legislatures to decide whether they're going to give away this power. And of course, there's tremendous incentive not to.
Tremendous. I mean, it is one of the, it's one of those discussions that we are going to study up until 2020. And it's going to be interesting because we have an election in 2020. Mm-hmm. So we're going to be running under the old maps, but actually drawing the new maps, which is going to become, and with the population density changes. See, one of the things that I've always said is that we can do a lot of things here as individuals, but for some reason, Mother Nature and society or whoever you believe in as spiritually has a way of sending us messages. If you look at rural Indiana, they are losing population at about a 5-7% clip on a yearly basis. But the people are not moving out of Indiana. They're moving to the surrounding counties surrounding Indianapolis in Indianapolis. So Indianapolis has seen a 9% increase in population. And that they cannot manipulate. You have to represent approximately the same number of people. So it's going to be interesting to see how the maps look. Now, one thing they could do is take little slivers out of Marion County and then draw them out in the suburbs. But that would be too blatant. I think they would, I mean, well, I don't know. But a lot more people who are smarter than me tend to believe that that's going to put a lot of pressure on us to actually come up with some sort of commission. But we ain't going to, the legislature is not going to give up that power.
What do you think, if you want to identify some positive steps that are being taken now to enfranchise traditionally more marginalized populations here in the U.S.? And I guess I would ask Professor Williams for examples of methods that you have seen in practice in regions where they also struggle with this issue. What good is happening out there that is trying to overcome some of the problems we've been talking about?
Well, in other countries in the world, tons of good things are happening. Democracy is sweeping the globe. Elections are freer and fairer than they ever have been. The stuff we focus on, in terms of elections in particular, is the electoral method. And again, we've just talked about majority voting, but there are lots of other electoral methods out there that people are adopting that, in fact, will positively enfranchise people. In addition, part of what's happened is that the practice of election observation has become much more professional and much more effective, and it's become a norm in new and struggling democracies that you ask election observers in.
Can I just interrupt just to ask who's supplying those generally?
So the UN, sometimes the US, a lot of CSOs. There are a lot of groups in Europe who do this. Part of what has really struck me in the last 10 years is that 10 years ago, it was routine to steal an election. People would vote, the government would falsify the vote, and declare that their people had won. We saw this all the time. Places that we've worked, like Liberia and Burma, where you would expect a falsified vote, have not seen falsified votes in the last little while. They have, in fact, been free and fair. Now, they focus much less on issues of registration and voter fraud because they're far less sophisticated than we are. So there are not these elaborate rules. In a place like Burma, you go down to vote, everybody knows you. The idea that you might try to vote twice is laughable, right? Because everybody will say, well, you just already voted, right? Often your hands are stamped. You know, that's a very simple way to avoid this. But what happens at the end of the day is there are these observers from outside, often observers from all the political parties. The ballots go in the box. Everybody observes the box. At the end of the day, you open the box, and everybody watches you count ballots. And it's worked, it's incredibly simple, but it's worked phenomenally well.
Right. What about here? What positives are we seeing in terms of what's working, if you will, to overcome some of the hurdles to not just getting at the minority vote, getting at the vote more broadly, but that is the focus of our discussion. So
I'll make it simple. What is Indiana doing to move up? Well, we had voting centers in Marion County in three different areas. And then after the voter turnout went up, we got rid of voting centers. I don't know if you got rid of them here, but we have, are they still, can you still vote early?
Yeah.
So we have different, fortunately for us in Indiana, we do allow counties to, we have a very strong home rule that allows you to have your own election commission who can allow you to make rules as long as they don't subvert the rules of the state of Indiana. So although you may have to have a photo ID, you can, here in Monroe County, decide you want to open up voting centers and turn out the voting population. And, you know, one of the things that I've proposed and have been shot down is automatic voter registration when you turn 18. And if you want a more secure registration system, that's the way you do it. Because you have to prove citizenship, You have to prove residency, or at least we have to know that you live here and you're automatically registered. I mean, what better way to forego this voter ready? I don't know if you've read recently, we are actually, the FBI is investigating and the state police is investigating voter registration fraud right now in Marion County, because the voter registration forms that were sent out were incorrect. Now, I can tell you, for all the rules that we have for everything that we do to vote, I just want to take a poll. How many of you guys read the ballot? Not who's on the ballot. I didn't say who's on the ballot. How many of you read the ballot? That means read the instructions. Tell the truth. Let's just tell the truth. I don't even read them. Point made. The laws change, and you don't even know, but we have to put it on the ballot and give you instructions. And at the end of the day, all you care about is what? Voting for the person who you believe best represents you. So why don't we just say everybody's registered? There's registration online going on in Oregon right now. In Colorado. You talk about easy. You want to make it easy. You just vote all the way up until the day of the election online. We can do everything else online. Can you buy a car online? You can do everything else. You can actually get a driver's license. Indiana moved forward, and we could even go the BMVs. You know, I thought it would never happen. You can go online and get your vehicle registration. But the point is, Indiana has not done, counties have done things to move it forward. But Indiana as a state, we have done very little.
You just listened to Professor David Williams, Professor Louis Fuentes Rauer, Professor Beth Cate, and Senator Greg Taylor discuss minority voting and disenfranchisement. This panel was hosted at Maurer School of Law on September 16th. The panel discussed reworking the Constitution, the history of minority voting in America, and the state of voting in Indiana.
Been listening to Standing Room Only. Join us each week for on-location recordings of lectures, town hall meetings, and other public forums. If there's a particular event you'd like to hear broadcast on this program, email that information to us directly at news@wfhb.org. The Standing Room Only archive is available online at wfhb.org/news. Standing Room Only is a production of our volunteer-powered news and public affairs department here on Community Radio, WFHB.